a monster, y'all done created. I better inaugurate it. Keep the bright lights out of her faces. You can't shake it, it ain't a way to swallow the hatred.
Killed and enslaved, feeding you Mexican. It looks real fucked up for you, Mexican.
Thank you for that, Holly. Thank you.
I don't know.
America's lost somewhere inside of literature. 11 million children are on the river. That's why I don't need for the second world. False media. You don't need to do it. 11 million children are on the river. That's why I don't need for the second world. False media. You don't need to do it. Enslaved energy Mexican.
The Washington Saragic
and collaborators. Their clandestine radio stations are the voices of the revolution.
To make it, I'd rather take it. Either that or me and my children is starving and naked. Rather be a criminal pro than a follow the matrix. Hey, it's me, the monster, y'all done created. I've been inaugurated.
Welcome to Indie Newswire, a weekly review of breaking news published on independent media center Newswires from all over the world.
We radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. It's the 26th of September. So, lots to talk about today. I have not done the show for a couple of weeks. We'll go through the indiemedia.us newswire. We'll hear lots about critical resistance. CR10 is this weekend, starting actually in just a couple of hours. We'll hear from Global Exchange and Adrian Fritsch Frankel. We'll hear from Reporters Without Borders. So there's all kinds of stuff out there. Ms. Frankel from Global Exchange is going to talk about fair trade cocoa chocolate. And Reporters Without Borders is a report earlier in the month about radio closures in Mexico. Stay tuned for all this and more on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. From time to time, I'm going to check in and jump in on the stream, the radio stream that's coming from CR10. It's called Thousand Kites Radio. It's running all weekend long. If you go to Critical Resistance's website, criticalresistance.org, and check out Thousand Kites Radio live from CR10, you can listen in. So whether you can be at CR10 or not, check out the Thousand Kites Radio web stream during the conference running today, tomorrow, and Sunday. You can also get your voice on Thousand Kites Radio, but check the website for more information on that. Here we go.
There's this friend that I go to see on a regular basis, like every weekend. I can remember when I first went there and I had to be patted down and to go through the sliding doors that shut tight behind you that made you felt like you yourself was a prisoner. But once I got into the waiting room and met my friend and saw the smile on his face as we talk and communicate about the outside world, for as how the children are doing, for as how the parents are doing, what's going on the outside world and keeping up with the environment. As I sit there and I notice that the people that's in the waiting room forget where they are when they see their family members come in, when they come in with the children. I see them hugging them, kissing them, giving their remarks like a father would give to his child, like, where is these new shoes, or is they in school? How they doing in school? Just because they're incarcerated doesn't mean that they don't have concern for their family and what's going on with the children in school, whether they're making good grades. I'm saying this to the legislators. I'm saying this to parents. Please keep a close eye on your children. See what they're doing. It's just hard for them to grow up into this world and get into trouble. Once they get there, there's just no way out, no way out.
You're listening to Thousand Kites Radio, your online source for prison news, art, and activism.
Up next are calls from all around the country directed to the Thousand Kites storyline, where community members can leave us messages with their stories, opinions, and concerns. To leave your message, call toll-free at 877-518-0606.
Hi, this message is for all prisoners and their families. And there's a way to be free on the inside. For those of you who are inside, my name is Mary Barr. I was incarcerated in New York City about 46 times in 3 years for drug law violations. I was addicted to drugs, and I spent years being homeless on the street. It was very dangerous being a woman alone in the street, and I'm lucky to be alive. I'm grateful to be alive. I just hope you guys are also grateful. When you get out, for those of you getting out, it's not going to be easy, I won't lie to you, but I promise you, if you stick to a different path, if you stay away from drugs, crime, whatever, I promise you, your life will be better. I've done such amazing things, things I never thought I'd do for other people. You know, writing articles, public education about the issues of, you know, criminal justice, some of the injustice, criminal injustice. And those are things I never thought I'd do or I'd be able to do for other people. I didn't think I could even help myself. So you guys, if I can do it, you can do it. Just stay strong and keep your faith.
Again, this is Thousand Kites Radio, broadcasting from Critical Resistance 10. I want to play a video about the conference that's going on now.
We're as good as we are bad, and we're as bad as...
I heard about this effort for Critical Resistance, and the idea was to bring together a gathering of people, people who had been in prison, policymakers, family members of prisoners, lawyers, academics, students and youth, a real broad range of people to examine this phenomenon called the prison industrial complex.
This gathering has been a long time coming. This may very well be the first time that so many of us have gathered together to figure out how to organize a national, sustained anti-prison campaign.
Real security is not locking up more and more people. That's not what real security is. Real security is knowing that you will have shelter, that you will have food, that you will have beauty in your life, that you have a future, that your family has a future. That's what security is.
America's prisons are becoming America's concentration camps. And there is no doubt that when you look at America's prisons and you look at the fact that there are 1.5 million people in America's prisons, and 65 to 70% are people of color and young people of color. And when you look on the other side and you see this bell curve, and there are 1.5 million people in higher education, but 80% are white, there's something really wrong.
We need to shut down a facility and get that money reallocated. It requires not just like suing, not even just legislation to close it down, but really an intense amount of organizing.
We're in the process right now of changing the ideology of who's an expert. Because I feel like if you've been incarcerated and you've been locked up, you're an expert on some levels, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's about time. It's about time.
You know, I think fundamentally, if you want to build a movement, you have to bring people together. And I think that's one of the most significant things that Critical Resistance has been able to do, is to bring people together who are specifically interested in some way in building a movement to end the prison industrial complex and building a real grassroots movement.
So I think some of the most important part of the work that was accomplished with Critical Resistance was that they took an obscure term and introduced that into public language. and public speak. So the concept of the prison industrial complex is something that people probably all around the country, if not all around the world, will use freely. Right now, 10 years ago, it was only used by academics.
Since then, I feel like 98 was a shift at the Center for Women's Development in terms of, like, we are going to, you know, go back into the jails, we're going to go back into the juvenile halls, we're going to hit the streets, we're going to tell people about their rights, like, we are going to organize and advocate also for young women.
Critical Resistance is not just an organization in my mind, it actually is part of, and maybe the leadership of, a movement to abolish prisons altogether in the United States. We know that's not going to happen in the next 5 years. But the fact that there are a lot of people that believe in that and that are working in various ways against the prison system as it exists is critically important because of who's getting locked up, how many people are getting locked up in this country. And, of course, if we don't oppose it, it's just going to continue to mushroom and grow.
Well, I am definitely having conversations with the people I work with in Insight and locally about what we can contribute to CR10. I do see this as another huge opportunity for us to really mark where what progress we've made over the past 10 years, and to really figure out where we need to move from here in the next 10 years at least.
We're here 10 years later because people feel a need for critical resistance, and that need is reflected in their willingness to be a volunteer member of critical resistance and do the organizing and do the grassroots fundraising and come to the events and write the letters and do all of those things. So I think that's really why we're here 10 years later, that we wouldn't be here but for people really feeling a need for critical resistance.
I'm seeing the fruits of the work that wasn't even at the first conference, and the fruits of the work that may not have been at the second conference, and the fruits of the work that may not have even been at the third conference. So I'm seeing the fruits of the work with the people who walk through the door and in the language that they use and what they embrace.
I also think that we'll be able to come together and share some of the concrete results that we've had from the work we've done together. I know a lot of things have been happening in different organizations and in different collaborations, regionally and nationally. And if we can get together and share what those have been, that's going to be another marking point in a way that we can bring together the power of the work that we've been doing in smaller organizational and collective ways to really spur on the movement for the next 10 years.
People who are older, who have been prison activists perhaps for many years, will be learning from and also helping teach the lessons to younger activists that are coming up and are determined to stop the prison industrial complex.
Youth are, like women, the fastest growing rate of incarceration, and they're targeting young people at a younger and younger age. They need to, one, understand the effects of the prison industrial complex and how they're being targeted, and have an active voice and an active role in this movement. Because many other movements have shut them out. And, you know, there's, you know, they can't vote, and there's policies coming down that are directly affecting them, and so they need to play an active role.
It's a process to build a movement that doesn't happen overnight. And so 10 years down the line, we have a lot of different pieces in place. And I think each one of these gatherings actually helps us build another piece in this movement that will eventually succeed.
The challenge is to grow. The challenge is to be organized about the ways that we consolidate and unite so that we have some unitary campaigns that we can actually measure progress on, in addition to the constant requirement that we respond to crises, because there are so many crises in all of our locations all the time that have to do with prison.
I actually do embrace the idea that we should build worlds without prisons. And it's not that far-fetched. And even for the people that it is far-fetched to at this point, we need that outer edge to have people at least walking in the right direction.
I do think Critical Resistance 10 gives people a unique opportunity to be part of history. I think just like, you know, maybe it's a little dramatic, but I actually don't think it is. Just like there were, you know, 12 people meeting in this print shop in London, and 50 years later, slavery was abolished. I think that, you know, this is an opportunity to be part of something that, you know, is historic, is unique, and I hope people will, you know, take advantage of that tremendous opportunity.
Freak Radio 101.1 FM. Speakers talking about this CR10 this weekend, going on right now, actually. Check out criticalresistance.org for the schedule. And I'm going to actually get to that real quick, because the schedule is pretty amazing. There's a lot going on. And so if you're on your way, it's the first session is today at 1:30. So, you know, leave town now, you might make it. But what we've got is I'm just going to read some of these, because there's an incredible amount of work that's gone into putting this conference on, and an incredible number of organizations and people who put in that work and are going to be there presenting all weekend long. So all weekend, letters and letters and more letters from prisoners and for prisoners. But just, again, just some examples, taking it down brick by brick, local anti-jail campaigns from around the country, from New York City, from New Orleans, from Bloomington, Indiana, organizing community-based responses to violence in communities of color, a workshop for people of color only by Insight, stopping the school-to-prison pipeline, two sessions by family and friends of Louisiana's incarcerated children. Immigration Detention 101 with folks from UC Davis Law School, Grassroots Leadership, Detention Watch Network, the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana. Getting real about alternatives to the police with a couple of cop watches, including Cop Watch in Portland, who we'll hear from later in the show as well. Because I was involved in a discussion over the weekend about the police review board and various police review boards, including the one here locally that disbanded a decade ago, or close to that, 5 years ago. Portland is a town that has both a cop watch and a police review board, and we'll hear a little bit from Cop Watch about the police review board and how a part of the system, again, this is later in the show, but part of the system, they've created a police review board, but it's not fully independent. It's not the kind of police review board that some of us would like to see, because there are lots of different models. And so we'll hear from Cop Watch on the police review board, which is kind of an interesting idea, by some of the folks, again, who will be at the conference this weekend. Also, prisons and mental health. The Freedom Road Socialist Organization and Critical Resistance are doing a workshop called Imagine What We Can Do Together. Cross-border resistance to state terrorism, including with CISPES, and the Block Report Radio and the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. The Struggle Inside, Legacies of Prison Activism from the 70s. Critical Negotiations. Prisoners Speak Out, The Destruction of California's Indigenous People, Purposeful Design. We Are at War, Grounding Abolition in Revolutionary Liberation. Media Justice, Criminal Justice. This is all today. That's all one session starting at 1:30. Those are your options for the one single solitary session that starts in just a couple of hours on Friday afternoon up in Oakland. And there's more. I skipped some. Gender militarism in the PIC, grassroots fundraising, how to write letters to the editor and op-eds in a way that increases their chances of being published, gender justice 101 for abolitionists, critical negotiations. These are, so again, youth justice roundtable at CR10. Now you've heard all of them. Those are the workshops available this afternoon. And there's a break, and there's just as many at 3:30. So I would recommend that anyone who can make it up there. And if you can't, continue to check out the web stream online at Thousand Kites Radio. You can get the link from criticalresistance.org, and you can get all the information that I'm reading here. Critical Resistance knows how to throw a conference. They also know how to throw a party. There's an opening night celebration tonight, 6:30 to 8:30 at the Scottish Rite Center Auditorium on Lakeside in Oakland. And then Saturday and Sunday, this is, again, all weekend long. On Saturday, you'll hear from just as many folks on just as many amazing topics and strategy sessions. Policing sex work and sex work migration, community accountability strategies for intimate violence, fighting the PIC by taking on private prison corporations, post-Katrina New Orleans, the reconstruction and rebuilding of a police state, strategies for ending the death penalty in California, Leonard Peltier and the First Nations political prisoners, the silencing of our resistance, with Dino Butler, among others. Yeah, I mean, this is education on incarceration. I feel like I should just keep reading, but I want you to check it out and I want you to go. There are regional caucuses from all over the place. Thousands of people are coming from across the country, from the Gulf Coast, from Alaska and Hawaii, from the Midwest, the Northeast, from the Plains States. This is a big gathering. So from local to nationwide, and report backs from movements, Native Hawaiian spirituality with the Move 9, the Genus 6, anti-racist organizing toward collective liberation, two sessions. So again, this is just ongoing and ongoing and ongoing. I'm just looking at this and I'm amazed at the amount of information that's going to be going on here. And so I, again, support and encourage anybody who can to make it up there. But for now, we'll leave Critical Resistance be. We'll come back to the web stream pretty shortly. I want to just do a quick read through similarly with the indymedia.us newswire, because as I said before, I've been gone for a couple weeks and there's a lot going on indymedia.us. So specifically, the execution of Troy Anthony Davis has been stopped. There's been a temporary stay of execution. It says that the U.S. Supreme Court will then decide Monday whether to hear Troy's appeal from the March 2008 Georgia Supreme Court denying him a new trial. For those of you who haven't followed the case, shame on you. Troy Anthony Davis was convicted and sentenced to death in 1989 in the state of Georgia, based exclusively on witness testimony. Evidence of his innocence emerged as most of these witnesses recanted their testimony, many alleging police coercion. He was scheduled to be executed on September 23rd at 7 p.m., but there was a stay issued. This update is... This is ongoing because it was a temporary stay and it's just an appeal to a higher court. So there's a lot of information on TroyAnthonyDavis.org, including updates. But Georgia is trying to execute this man, and I would encourage you to get more information about the case, first of all, and pay attention as this last-minute appeal works its way, perhaps, to the U.S. Supreme Court. There's also been some financial news. You may have been paying attention to the corporate bailouts going to banks and investing institutions, including the federal government taking over Washington Mutual Bank yesterday. This has not been without a response from the people who don't necessarily own stock or have investments at some of these banks or don't work for Lehman Brothers. October 25th, there was a protest on Wall Street. I'm guessing the person who posted this meant to write September 25th. But there's some great photos on, New York City's indie media, about, you know, the fairly large, parade of folks marching down Wall Street and stopping in front of some of these offices. No banker left behind. It's deregulation, no Bush bailout, people against highway robbery. There's a lot of interesting photos here that I'd recommend you check out. Greed kills. Those are going on across the country, but specifically in the financial sectors of major cities. There was one on the 25th in San Francisco as well, at the Federal Reserve. There are photos at Indy Bay. An interesting one that I noticed here on Portland IMC. On September 11th, 2008, the Olympia City Council voted to repeal Olympia's nuclear-free zone ordinance. Those who are listening in Santa Cruz might know that Santa Cruz has also passed a nuclear-free ordinance that is supposed to declare that the nuclear weapons and technology is unsafe and unwelcome in this town. This county is another matter. We do have Lockheed Martin facilities in Bonny Doon that don't necessarily have nuclear materials, but they might. The information is hard to come by and shoddy and redacted. But also, we know that the systems are contributed to, parts go to nuclear systems from Santa Cruz County. But in Olympia, they just decided to scrap the ordinance altogether. They just repealed it on September 11th. So I thought that was interesting. And there's all kinds of stuff going on all across the country, as you might know, in response to this financial crisis. The gambling economy goes bust, as New York City's indie media says it. The legal struggle is also continuing for Rebel Diaz, also New York City indie media. The South Bronx-based hip-hop activists Rodrigo and Gonzalo Venegas were aggressively arrested by NYPD on June 18th, and they said they were trying to help a street vendor on Southern Boulevard in Hunts Point who they felt were being harassed by police officers. I've reported on this story because they were, after that violent arrest, essentially for cop watching, their home was raided for no apparent reason. And so they're working their ways through different ways to get the story out, different ways to talk to folks about police accountability and find out what happened, get information about why they were targeted or how this could just happen without any response. But they're continuing to make music and be community organizers too. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is making its way through the country on tour targeting Chipotle. Their tour is called the Chipocracy Tour, demanding that Denver-based Chipotle Mexican Grill stop ignoring human rights of farm workers and live out the true meaning of its marketing slogan, quote, "Food with Integrity." You should know that Chipotle is a McDonald's company and McDonald's answer to Taco Bell. And that Chipotle's Food with Integrity label doesn't seem to include fair labor standards for the folks picking their tomatoes. So if you follow the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in their campaigns against Taco Bell, Burger King, McDonald's, and on, the current target, Chipotle, and their Food with Integrity advertising. So, again, there's so much going on, and I just wanted to read through that newswire real quick, and get you some indiemedia.us news. I'm gonna do the same for Indie Bay in just a minute, but here's a song first. It's by a band from San Francisco called Death to Anders, and it's called Ghost Rock. We'll be right back. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. That's Death Anders with Ghost Rock. So yesterday in Tabasco in Mexico, a radio host who campaigned against organized crime was gunned down. Reporters Without Borders voices its support for EXA FM, a local radio station based in Villahermosa, the capital of Tabasco. Following the fatal shooting of one of its program hosts, Alejandro Zenon Fonseca Estrada, on the 23rd of September. The organization is outraged that neither federal nor state investigators had contacted the station nearly 24 hours after the murder. Quote, the lack of any immediate reaction from the police and judicial authorities is all the more incomprehensible as the Mexican Congress is currently debating a bill initiated by President Felipe Calderon that would make it a federal crime to attack the media. Age 33, Fonseca hosted a morning show on EXA FAMA called El Padrino, and he was widely known by the nickname of Padrino Fonseca. He was also an activist who campaigned against organized crime and headed an NGO. On the evening of his murder, he was on the streets with a loudspeaker and, together with several colleagues, was putting up stickers criticizing abductions. He was at the intersection of two avenues at about 9 p.m. when a pickup with a Texan license plate pulled up alongside him. The passengers in the cabin asked him what he was doing with his stickers. Then they opened fire and drove off. Hit in the chest, Fonseca died after being rushed to the city's LA Los Angeles hospital. The staff of EXAFM told Reporters Without Borders that by 6 p.m. yesterday, they had still not been contacted by any officials. They also said they were unaware of any prior threats against Fonseca, who started his program in 2001 on Radio Tabasco before moving it to EXA-FAMA. He also participated in a local TV program. His colleagues said El Padrino, which was about social issues and had many listeners, might not survive his death as he was its soul. The program may not continue then. So, Free Radio 101.1, I'm going to rejoin that Death to Anders song and we'll get on the air. See ya. Our cheerless conquest. My funds, your guns, Dow Jones in progress. For you will be your tragic heart. Again, Death to Anders on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. As I mentioned just a minute ago, you're listening to the Indie Newswire show. And today we have Adrian Fritz-Frankel on the phone today from Global Exchange. Again, she is the Fair Trade Cocoa Campaigner for Global Exchange. And we're going to talk a little bit today about the state of organizing in that field, as well as something going on. That's a creative a program that Global Exchange has put together for the Halloween holiday. So, Adrian, can you hear us?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank
you for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
How long have you been working on Fair Trade Cocoa?
For almost 2 years.
And what's the current state of organizing in that field? It's a big market. It's a big commodity. It's something that that is, you know, coffee and then bananas and then there's been a lot of organizing around chocolate specifically just in the past few years.
That's right. You know, it's a really exciting time to get involved with fair trade chocolate and with issues around cocoa in general. I mean, who doesn't love chocolate? You know, like I can just hear your listeners like thinking in their heads, "I love chocolate. I love to do chocolate. Work on chocolate." So yeah, that's what our organizers and activists do, and I would say that there's really growing interest. As many people know, Global Exchange has been involved in fair trade issues for many, many years. We worked on a campaign, or rather led a campaign, to ask Starbucks to add fair trade coffee to its its roster. And, of course, now you can find fair trade coffee in Starbucks all over the country. Starbucks is the number one purchaser of coffee, of fair trade coffee in North America. And so what we're really trying to do is make chocolate and cocoa into the next fair trade coffee so that people all over the country can access fair trade chocolate products. And this is really important. If you don't mind, I'd actually love to talk a little bit about why this is an important issue and why people should organize.
Yeah, my next question is so why chocolate, and what's going on in the production of chocolate that makes it a good target?
Okay, sorry to jump the gun a little bit.
No, perfect.
There. All right, so there are several issues related to chocolate that people should be concerned about when they go out and purchase a product made with cocoa. And, of course, cocoa is in a lot of products, from your chocolate and your ice cream to your hand lotion, because cocoa butter is used there. And so when you go out and use and purchase a piece of chocolate or something with cocoa in it, one of the really disturbing things is that cocoa was almost certainly produced using abusive child labor or actual outright child slavery. And so in West Africa, there was a study done by the International Labor Organization and the U.S. State Department. They found that 284,000 children, that's over a quarter of a million children, labor in abusive child labor conditions in the cocoa fields of West Africa alone. Now, West Africa produces actually over 70% of the world's cocoa supply. And so what that means is that, you know, it's really commingled with all of the cocoa that we purchase. And so of these children, 12,000 actually work in conditions of slavery. And again, according to the estimates of these to respected organizations, and media reports such as the BBC and other respected media outlets have found that the conditions of these child slaves are extremely serious. Children are beaten severely for trying to escape. They are beaten for any infractions. They are not fed adequately. They're locked up at night and unable to go out and use the restroom. Really, really serious conditions of slavery, and not paid for their work, of course. So there are these really serious conditions. Now, if you contrast that with fair trade cocoa is grown under conditions, under standards that prohibit the use of any type of slavery, adult slavery, child slavery, any slavery, and also prohibit the use of abusive child labor. Abusive child labor is when the child is either under extremely hazardous working conditions. For example, 153,000 of those children are applying pesticides with no protective gear. Or the work interferes with their ability to go to school. So they can help around the family farm after school, but if it interferes with their schooling, that's a violation of international law. So that's one example of one of the contrast between fair trade and conventional chocolate.
So as consumers and as human beings, we all bear some responsibility for these conditions, but who specifically is profiting from it?
Well, the cocoa industry in general, cocoa companies, when you go out and buy that chocolate bar, that money is going to that chocolate company, and they're not paying their workers appropriately, and so people can really speak out about this and say, hey, you know, I really want to pay for the labor that goes behind my chocolate, and the way to do that, there are many ways people can do that. You know, for one thing, look for the fair trade certified label. The fair trade certified label means that you can trust that that chocolate product was grown under conditions where you know, there was no where the standards were no abusive child labor and no slavery, and not to mention, you know, all of the other wonderful benefits of fair trade, because fair trade also protects the environment and ensures that that farmers have a pathway out of poverty.
So the work that Global Exchange does, is Global Exchange one of the agencies that's certifying, or are they working directly with farmers? What kind of work does Global Exchange do on the grounds in coffee producing, or excuse me, in chocolate cocoa producing areas?
Yeah, so this actually loops back to the question you were just asking about, you know, what people can do. Global Exchange is not the certifying body. The certifying body is called Transfer. They happen to be based in Oakland, right here in the area, but they certify all the cocoa and other products nationally. Global Exchange is an advocacy organization, and we empower people just like your listeners to get involved in these issues through a variety of different, opportunities. Our Fair Trade Chocolate Campaign gives people these opportunities. The main project we're working on right now is called Sweet Smarts. And so we do a lot of work with children and with schools, or empower adults to be able to work with children in schools. We have a fair trade curriculum for elementary schools, and we'll soon be publishing also a high school curriculum for schools. And these are all available on our website, globalexchange.org/cocoa. And if you go to that website, you'll find the curricula and also all the other programming that we're doing. And basically, we are creating the opportunity for people to, either as individuals or as clubs in their own communities, to reach out to their neighbors and educate them, neighbors and stores and schools and everyone in their own community, about the issues in the cocoa industry and how fair trade can make a difference in transforming people's lives and making a brighter future in these communities. And so, for example, one of the ways that people can get involved is through reverse trick-or-treating, and this is coming up right now, actually. The way this works is that groups of trick-or-treaters nationwide, especially children, of course, but if adults want to participate, they are completely welcome to do so. And so what we do is we send out free kits to people. They pay only for shipping. And each kit has fair trade chocolates and informational cards. And what you do is you go out on Halloween or whatever day you're celebrating Halloween. Some people celebrate a little bit early, the weekend before. And so these groups of children who are trick-or-treating go door-to-door on their normal trick-or-treating round and hand fair trade chocolate back to adults, reversing the normal trick-or-treating tradition. And that chocolate, of course, is fair trade, and it's attached to this informational card that tells the household about the problems in the cocoa industry in terms of labor, environment, poverty, etc., and how fair trade provides a delicious solution to that problem. And so last year, it was the first year of the program, we actually reached 47,000 households in North America. This program happens both in the U.S. and Canada. And this year, we're actually going to reach almost 250,000 households in North America. But we need your help, actually, to do that. We are inviting people to visit reversetrickortreating.org, and that will connect them with a website where they can order one of these free kits. The deadline to order kits is actually October 1st. That's just in a few days. If you are wanting to organize a youth group or a congregation or a school or a classroom to do this with multiple groups of trick-or-treaters, if you are an individual and you'd like to participate, either an adult or a kid that would like to participate in this program, the deadline to sign up is October 13th. And again, that website is reversetrickortreating.org.
And so the idea is that the kids going door-to-door hand something back. Are you encouraging them not to take the Hershey's? Or?
You know, we want people to do whatever they feel comfortable with. People last year did different things. This is a holiday that everyone enjoys, and, you know, children should feel comfortable about that. So if they want to take the candy, they're welcome to do that. Some families actually sent the chocolate back to the manufacturer with a letter saying, you know, we're rejecting your chocolate, and, you know, we want you to resolve the problems in the cocoa industry with child labor and with environment and poverty. And we're eating fair trade instead this Halloween. So that's what some families did. Others, you know, kept the chocolate, whatever they felt comfortable with. But the important thing is for people to be headed down the line of trying to purchase more and more fair trade chocolate products. And in fact, we also have something if people want to hand out fair trade from their doorstep. Our fair trade online store actually can provide chocolate. We have a fair trade holiday action kit and then just regular bags of fair trade chocolate that you can purchase. And that's at our Global Exchange online store. You can link to that from globalexchange.org.
The action kit title makes me chuckle, but
it is actually an action kit. You know, it's it has like streamers that you can put in front of your door, and it has a whole poster that says, you know, our family serves fair trade chocolate, and it also has these action cards you can use. So you hand out to each child that comes to your door, you hand out a piece of chocolate, and you also hand out this card that has a letter to World's Finest Chocolate, which is actually our corporate target right now, the corporation that we're asking to go fair trade. Of course, we're asking all of them to, but this is the one we're particularly focused on. And World's Finest Chocolate, for those of you who remember when we were kids, you know, walking door to door and selling chocolate for $1 a piece as fundraisers for our schools, that's the company that we're asking to end its hypocrisy and go fair trade, because they say that they fund education for kids, and they're not actually doing that for kids who are producing the cocoa. And so there's actually an action card that people can hand to the kids at their door, and those kids can send that in to World's Finest Chocolate asking them to go fair trade.
Right on. So I've talked to some family about this and tried to, you know, get some information out there and such, and the answer I've gotten a couple times, not every time, is that I'm ruining both chocolate and Halloween. I'm curious what your answer is to just the idea of one more feel good activity and how this makes concrete changes.
Yeah, you know, first I want to kind of respond to what your folks said to you about ruining Halloween. It's interesting because I was actually really shocked last year at how much, like, intensely positive feedback we received. People really felt that it enhanced the holiday for them. We definitely encourage children to accept the candy that they're given, to feel good about that. What we're doing is complementing the holiday that exists and adding an additional tradition, new tradition of also giving candy back. And the way that a lot of parents and children respond to this is, and especially parents, they talk about how Halloween, one parent actually called it a gimme, gimme holiday, where, you know, you actually create this opportunity for your kids to walk door to door and literally demand that other adults give them candy. And that's kind of, for a lot of parents, that's very uncomfortable because it really runs counter to a lot of the other lessons that they teach their children at home. And so this way, children actually give something back. They give something directly to the adult that's giving them something, which is like this really like personal interaction. And apparently the adults at the door responded really positively to this act by the children. And then also the children are giving something back to the world giving something back to their peers in Africa and other cocoa-producing regions. The ability to go to school, the ability to escape from slavery and from abusive child labor and all these things, and the ability to escape from poverty. And so, you know, everyone I talked to just absolutely raved about what an incredible, rich tradition this was. And also, you know, classrooms and school teachers and congregations really felt this injected meaning into the holiday. And so I think that once these families participate, they will they'll be converted to the beauty of reverse trick-or-treating. With regard to it being a feel-good, you know, is it just another feel-good thing, or is it, you know, does it make a concrete impact? I think that one really special thing about reverse trick-or-treating is that, you know, a lot of the people I think who participate are people who already may have heard of fair trade or may already be part of social justice movements in some way. But by going door to door, we're reaching out to people who may have never even heard of fair trade at all before. And this is really special to be able to raise the concerns about the cocoa industry with people who may be completely in the dark about what's going on, and then also to raise awareness about the fair trade label and fair trade certification, not only for cocoa, but also for coffee and all different products, you know, to make people aware that this exists. And when you look at the numbers, I mean, we reached 47,000 households last year, and this year we're reaching almost 250,000 households. Just the scale of shifting the market so powerfully. So, I'm hoping that it's not just another feel-good thing, but really does have a concrete impact in generating buzz and interest in fair trade and all the positive impacts of fair trade.
So what other, I guess my question is what's next? What other markets, what other products are people considering or targeting, corporations targeting with regards to just having, you know, fair labor and production standards across the board? There's always a campaign going, you know, with a union or with a fair trade organization. And it seems like kind of one by one, products are getting added to that consciousness of, you know, responsible consumerism or responsible, you know, being a responsible buyer in one way or another. So I guess what might be see in the next years? What might come up as another industry that needs some consciousness in considering how this product is produced?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I think you're really you know, hitting exactly the important issue. I think it's all industries, really. I mean, Once people start thinking about where products come from, and especially this is true for children sometimes don't realize that a product doesn't just come from the store, that there's kind of a backstory behind it. You know, I think that once people start thinking about, oh, my chocolate, it comes from somewhere and there's something wrong with it, and oh, my coffee, you know, there's something wrong with where that comes from. You know, people do start thinking more broadly and looking at everything that they're buying and you know, putting their pressure on industry and really looking for, you know, looking to things like, for example, the Green Festival. You know, Global Exchange has this annual Green Festival this year in San Francisco. It'll be in November, and it's a wonderful way to learn about all the new trends in all different industries towards becoming socially responsible, towards having fair trade practices, etc. The more narrowly, to respond to your question, there are a number of new products coming online that are fair trade certified. There's flowers, there's tea has been around for a while, there's bananas, there are you know, really quite a few different types of products. But I mean, bananas is actually one really interesting area, and tells us a story about something that kind of goes beyond what we even think about as fair trade. So when we talk about fair trade, we're largely talking about small farmers. For most, like for example, coffee and cocoa. You know, usually when we think in the public discourse about issues of labor, we're thinking about factories. And the real beauty of the fair trade system is that we're not talking about fair labor conditions in factories, which are also critically important, but we're actually talking about farmer ownership. We're talking about people who would otherwise be workers in someone else's fields, instead being able to own their own farm and really build a much brighter future for their family because they have the pride and dignity of ownership. And so in the area of a couple of these companies, there's, for example, one company called OK Bananas, and they have fair trade product where the farmers actually own the brand. So the OK company is actually owned by farmers. And there's also a company in West Africa, Divine Chocolate. They are owned by the farmers of the Kwapa Cocoa cooperative in Ghana. And so I call this fair trade extreme because not only do the farmers get the fair trade price, but they actually like earn the profits from this company. So this is like a really exciting new trend that consumers should look for in terms of looking for fair trade products.
I want to step back just a little bit to the actual production. I mean, we kind of touched on some statistics and information about so workers are, you know, it's produced by child labor or in some cases even child slavery. And you know, where workers aren't paid and are underfed, what are the circumstances that lead to those kind of conditions? How do people end up in that situation, and how did this kind of start?
Yeah, it's it's a pretty sad story actually. In these areas, the sending countries are countries like Mali and Burkina Faso, countries that are some of the poorest countries in the world. And they are right next to these cocoa-producing regions. And so children and youth will go to the border areas looking for a job. And so and sometimes, you know, they'll be planning to go. Other times, they won't even tell their parents. They will just, like, sneak away in the middle of the night and leave. Obviously, this is every parent's worst nightmare. And so they'll go to the border area and they'll look for a job, and there'll be people there asking, you know, hey, kid, do you want a job? And, of course, that's what they're there for. So they say, yes, I want a job. And, so they get trundled off to a waiting minivan, not knowing that they have just crossed the boundary into being trafficked as a slave. And so they get into the minivan thinking that this is just going to be a normal job. They're going to go there. They're going to make money. They're going to come home. They get into the van. They are taken across the border, and then they're sold into slavery. So it's a very abrupt change in life circumstances for these children.
And this is the chocolate that ends up in your standard Hershey bar, your gas station chocolate is what I tend to call it. The stuff that's just readily available, especially in Halloween. The cheap, readily available chocolate is produced by child trafficking and child slavery then?
That's right. The chocolate supply is tainted by this child labor system. So some of it is this, you know, like I said, 12,000 of the kids estimated are in this situation of trafficking or slavery, or, you know, separated from their families in some way, and that's out of 284,000 children who are also under abusive child labor conditions. So, yeah, really, because of the way that the chocolate industry works, where all of the cocoa is aggregated by a small number of companies, then, you know, it really means that a huge percentage of the chocolate supply is tainted by this child labor. And, you know, people can speak out about that, by visiting our website, sending a free fax to World's Finest Chocolate and saying that's just not acceptable.
The aggregated system also allows some of the companies that actually on this end are doing the selling and the marketing to say, not our problem, not our fault, that it's in the control of another part of industry that we don't have any control over.
That's exactly right, yeah. That way they can just, keep, pointing fingers and passing the buck. But what we want is for industry to take responsibility and to stop passing the buck and start using the fair trade label, fair trade standards, and fair trade cooperatives, so that farmers can have this very contrasting situation of being able to send their children to school, send their children to the doctor, afford food for their family. It's a big difference.
Right on. So again, you can get more information on this at globalexchange.org and globalexchange.org/cocoa. Adrian Fitch-Frankel's bio is on there as well. She's also worked on campaigns for conflict-free diamonds and sweat-free legislation here in the Bay Area and as part of Global Exchange, as well as the current coffee and cocoa campaigns that are going on. Thank you very much for your time and your work. Is there anything else you would like to say to the listeners here?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me, first of all. And please do visit reversesugartreating.org and globalexchange.org/cocoa to get involved in Sweet Smarts and make a difference.
Yeah, if that campaign and that that action sounds interesting. That deadline is again coming up October 1st for folks to visit and get those kits.
That's right. October 1st for groups like youth groups, congregations, schools, and October 13th for individuals.
Adrian, thank you very much for your time, and hope to talk to you again.
Me too. Thank you for having me. Take care.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. That was Adrian Fitch-Frankel from Global Exchange. We're going to continue here. It's just about to be 11, and I want to play that Copwatch piece that I mentioned. So this comes from KBOO. It's Portland Copwatch responding to the annual report by the Police Review Board that seems to be co-opted a little bit.
What they actually report is that the complaints about use of force is down 34%. So one can conclude that people aren't complaining to the IPR as much about use of force as they used to. Not necessarily that the actual use of force is down, because they don't have statistics about the use of force in here. They published that in a separate report. There was one put out last April, and they're going to work on another one this November. But they actually do not have statistics in there about the actual use of force. And I think that's a problem. I think the way that they atomize information and take it and put it in different places is a real detriment to them as a police oversight body. They should be compiling this information. To their credit, they included statistics about how often the Use of Force Review Board met to look at deadly force cases and what kinds of discipline were handed out, none of which, by the way, were related to the actual use of force. They were all related to procedural issues that the officers engaged in, but not the fact that they shot and killed somebody. What's interesting is that they have, from the very, very beginning, put out their own survey instrument to find out what people thought about the system. And they actually interviewed people who had used the old system, PIAC, in the last years before the IPR took over. And then since then, they've used the same survey. And their report shows that there's a very low satisfaction rate. I think it's like a 25% satisfaction rate with the overall system. But they also say, well, pay no attention to that. But in about the same paragraph where they say pay no attention to our survey because very few people respond to it, they say, oh, look at this. People who were happy with the outcome of their case went up by 11% this year. And which one is it? Don't pay attention to it or look how much it's improved? And what's funny is that it went up by 11%, but it still topped out at way below 50%. So I don't really know how that benefits them, except that, as I said, it makes you look better when you put out a figure that says, oh, you know, our approval rating went up by 11%, but when you don't, in that same sentence, say, but the approval rating is still below 50%, I think that's dishonest.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. Real quick from the Indie Bay calendar here in Santa Cruz, there are a couple events. There's one last night, and there's another tonight and tomorrow. With regards to Oaxaca solidarity, self-determination, and the defense of community rights in Oaxaca and beyond. There are film events with Simon Cedillo. Last night at the Brown Beret office, Simon spoke and showed some films. Tonight, the event is at the RCNV at 515 Broadway. Tonight at 7:30 p.m. with Tres Americas Coffee as well. And then tomorrow evening, also at 7, at the Monterey Peace and Justice Center, there's an event in Monterey, 801 Lighthouse Avenue. These events are all free. No one turned away for lack of funds, but donations are, of course, welcome to support communities in resistance. So these events, again, tonight at the RCNV and tomorrow in Monterey, are a speaker tour in defense of community rights in Oaxaca. Oaxaca was big on the radar, and there's a lot of information coming out of Oaxaca a couple years back, and a lot of it has dried up. The struggles, of course, continue. we still have Ulysses in quote unquote power down there. He's still the governor. Elections have come and gone. Oppo has met and continued to attempt organizing. Different fractional splinter groups have come and gone from the coalition, etc. So getting more recent information from what's going on down there is critical to stay informed and understand what's going on as certain things come up. For example, Plan Mexico and military aid to Mexico and the federal government there. Simon Cedillo is a community-based human rights activist and filmmaker whose work has centered on placing skills, cameras, and editing equipment in the hands of communities in resistance so that they can document their own histories and human rights situation. Cedillo spent the last 6 years documenting and teaching community-based video documentation in indigenous communities in Oaxaca, in immigrant communities in the U.S., and with youth of color across the United States. Today, Cedillo shares some experiences and perspective for international audiences in the U.S. and Europe on the local and global implications of the Oaxacan people's struggle. Through lectures, workshops, and screenings, Cedillo helps open a powerful space for dialogue on the effects of neoliberalism on indigenous communities in Oaxaca, immigrant communities around the world, and communities of color in the U.S. Through collaborative media projects, Cedillo's work has contributed to a growing network of community-based media activism, whose primary objective is to share, teach, and learn from one another about popular community-based resistance and the collective construction of horizontal networks of popular power. Cedillo is currently on tour screening short film segments from Oaxaca and presenting workshops on Neoliberalism 101, From Militarism to Paramilitarism, Mesoamerican Indigenous Principles of Unity and Resistance, Challenging International Solidarity, Alternative Media, Human Rights, and Self-Determination, The Commodification of Sustainability and Resistance, The Fight for Community Rights, and Bringing It Home, The Effects of the Neoliberal Political Economy on Immigrant Communities and Communities of Color in the U.S. So that's tonight at 7:30 at the RCNV, and tomorrow at 7 at the Monterey Peace and Justice Center. Simon Cedillo speaking about the defense of community rights and Oaxaca speakers tour. Please come out to support that. The other thing is, again, from Reporters Without Borders. So I mentioned the radio host being gunned down just earlier this week in Mexico. Earlier in the month, Reporters Without Borders issued a report. It was issued on September 10th. Lack of clear legislation and government violations of international commitments reinforce community media's fear of closures. So in addition to being targeted, media workers in Mexico are being targeted in the case of the gentleman in Tabasco, apparently by narco traffickers. But if you follow Mexican politics and history, you know that narco traffickers, the military, and the government have an interesting relationship, shall we say, in many cases, making it pretty clear that what's happening in communities of resistance is that there's some collusion, there's some overlap between those in power, whether those in power are moving drugs or those in power are embezzling funds meant for the community, or whether those in power are simply controlling the ruling party's grasp on power. It doesn't matter whether it's the military or the government who are separate in some regards, but whether that's the military, the government, or the paramilitaries, or the narco traffickers, or whoever is armed to make things happen and maintain hegemony and control in Mexico, the press and the media are often targeted by any and all of those three overlapping power structures. So I'm going to read part of this, but again, rsf.org, Reporters Sans Frontieres, Reporters Without Borders, has another press release about Mexico. So Reporters Without Borders calls on Mexico's federal authorities to clarify the legal situation of community radios that are threatened with closure or repeated suspension. The case of Radio Totopo, a station based in the southern state of Oaxaca, is one of many that highlight Mexico's failure to respect international agreements protecting community media. Some stations operate under the community label, although their format and goals are clearly commercial. Community media need to have legislation that meets their criteria. At the same time, the way broadcast frequencies are assigned results in a discretionary system that very often discriminates against small indigenous community stations that a government is supposed to help under the Constitution and certain international treaties. Reporters Without Borders added, confiscating the equipment of more and more stations on the grounds that they are broadcasting illegally will not solve anything. Our organization will support any constructive initiative involving the authorities and the national and international organizations that represent community media. Radio Totopo broadcasts 95% of its programs in the Zapotec language of the four indigenous communities in its region. One of its coordinators, Carlos Sanchez Martinez, told Reporters Without Borders that the station fears it could be closed after a series of raids in August by the PFP, some against 14 stations that claimed to be community media, although some were regarded as commercial. Some stations were launched on the initiative of Oaxaca State Governor Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, who has often clashed with the local press and whose bodyguards were alleged to have been involved in the murder of U.S. cameraman Brad Will of the Indy Media Agency during a serious social and political crisis in the autumn of 2006. The fears of Oaxaca's indigenous media have also been fueled by the murders of Teresa Bautista Flores and Felicitas Martinez, both employees of La Voz del Rompe el Silencio, the voice that breaks the silence, a radio station broadcasting to the Trique indigenous community. On April 7th, in the small locality of Putla de Guerrero, their murders have not been solved. More generally, as Reporters Without Borders and other organizations, the Mexican branch of the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, the Association for the Right to Inform, and Article 19, have noted discretionary practices continue to prevail in the assignment of frequencies and closure of radio stations. Between June 12th and 17th of July, no fewer than 40 of the 131 available frequencies were assigned to mainly commercial radio stations at the expense of community and educational stations. Several media were closed or had their equipment seized by federal police during the same period. At the same time, many frequency requests by community radio stations were rejected. So, again, there's legislation, there are agreements in place. For example, the San Andreas Accords, which are problematic in many ways, basically guarantee indigenous access to the airwaves and community access to the media. But as you might understand or recognize is also the case in this country, what is written and what is said, what is passed, what is law, is applied in some interesting ways. And that's the case in Mexico as well, where you have a law that demonstrates specifically that the indigenous population has their own media. That's what the Constitution says. That's what the San Andreas Accords say. But that media and that permission, that is... contingent, that depends on the whims of those in power. So keep checking Reporters Without Borders, keep paying attention to what's happening to those who try to speak truth to power in Mexico. It's an extremely important precedent. It's an extremely important story. It's an extremely important movement for those in this country who benefit so much from the exploitation of people to the global south, and specifically to our neighbor to the global south, to understand more concretely, to have real information about what's going on in Mexico in community movements to make social change, because those who are trying to make social change are running up against, of course, the power of the Mexican government. But now we're looking at having military aid directly from the U.S., guns bought and paid for by American taxpayers who are used to repress communities who are trying to get information out on radio stations, for example. So that's from Reporters Without Borders, a recent report on what's going on in Mexico. And again, tonight and tomorrow night, you can get more information directly from what's going on with regards to media in Mexico at the RCNV tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow at 7 at the Monterey Peace and Justice Center.